Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. Coming up for you this morning, we talk to entrepreneur, investor and overall food king, Roscommon's John Stapleton, the life in the waters of the Grand Canal, and an emigrant returns to their Sligo farm. We're on 51551 countrywide at rte.ie, but we're going to begin with an issue that has been decades in the making, still causing headaches for many small-scale farmers. It is the demise of small abattoirs across the country. For farmers producing small quantities of milk for local consumption in independent farm shops and retailers, well, they cannot exist without small abattoirs, and yet they continue to close. For farmers like Peter Toomey of Glenbrook Farm in Whitecross, in Cork, it means their future hangs in the balance.
We run a 20-sow free-range pig farm in White's Cross. There's a huge fear for us right now that all this is at risk. Our local abattoir has closed and we find ourselves driving to Port Laois now to get our pigs processed. This is my problem, but this is also facing every small producer in Ireland. The abattoir that we used to use in Mitchelstown was also being used by people from County Clare, County Waterford, County Offaly, from the lower parts of West Cork. Like, the reality facing not just me, but every small producer in Ireland is that local meat will not be able to get processed in a local abattoir.
And he said the word right, meat, not milk. That's Peter Toomey there of glenbrookfarm.ie. Well, Hannah Quinn Mulligan farms with her grandmother Catherine just outside of Croom in Limerick. And a few weeks ago, Hannah's rare breed Tamworth pigs gave birth to 8 piglets. But finding a small local abattoir that will kill, butcher and process the pig meat is proving exceptionally hard.
Well, piggy biggies, look at you. They are getting so fat. Look how big they got.
I know, for piglets, they were tiny when they were born.
They got tiny, they're huge. Look at that one. They are so big. Do you have to wean them now?
I have to wean them in about a week or so. Yeah, it's mad how time flies. I mean, when they were born, it was a complete shock because I wasn't expecting them at all. Because remember, I bought 4 pigs and I was adamant that we weren't going to have piglets because I'd seen Clarkson's farm and I knew what happened in terms of piglet mortality and clumsy mothers. But actually, they've been okay. Oh yeah, they love apples. And then 2 turned out to be unexpectedly pregnant and we have 8 little piglets. Oh, look at the babies. Look at them eating the apples.
So sweet. Oh, look at the mothers taking the apples from them. Oh, that's so sweet.
Some people say the apples make their meat very succulent as well.
Yes, I'd imagine that, yes. That's what I thought. I thought, you know.
I guess speaking of succulent meat, it might be rude to bring up in their earshot, but
yes.
One day the little bonovs will be bacon.
Yeah, I know. I know. What are you going to do, though? Are you keeping them all? We have 8.
That'd be a lot to keep, but at least I'd have them then for next year because beef prices are insane.
Yeah.
I can't afford to buy beef for the shop. It's also finding an abattoir, because I had a small-scale abattoir lined up to do the business.
Yes.
And get them processed, and now they've stopped killing pigs for small-scale people, so I have to find someone else. So the nearest abattoir is over an hour away. It's getting harder and harder to find abattoirs to kill pigs.
Really, yes. That's a lot of time spent on the road, isn't it?
So and ideally you'd like to keep it as local as possible and it's less stress on the animal, you know, she's not travelling as far.
Well, ask our local butcher, Pat Barry. He has contacts. He knows everyone in the locality. You are sort of somewhere close by.
Morning, Pat.
Good morning.
How are you?
Always one to heed my grandmother's advice, I took myself down to Pat Barry, our local butcher in Croom. And as it happened, just as I was arriving, so was Noreen Hartigan. She's the wife of Des Hartigan. The pair used to run the shop before Pat Barry took over, and I asked her what it had looked like in the days she was running it.
And I got married into the business, and I'm here over 50 years.
And Pat's taken over now, but Pat and I are going to talk about local abattoirs. And I guess something that's interesting is that there used to be an abattoir at the back of this butcher shop, like a lot of butcher shops in towns throughout Ireland. And you were here when the abattoir was still here.
I was, oh yes, yeah. We reared our own heifers, bought them and reared them on the grass and brought them in here once a week and killed them.
And was there kind of trade from local farmers coming, getting their heifers killed as well?
Oh, we did deep freeze all the time, yeah. We did deep freeze. It was a big business that time.
And why did it stop?
We were closed. The department closed us down because we couldn't guarantee that the slaughterhouse would be mice-proofed. That's one of the things at the time. I was very cross about that because we were in control of what we sold, because we knew our own rearing, or we bought locally, as Pat does. Mm. You know, Pat rears his own.
You go back 25 years ago, there was two abattoirs in Croome. There was two butcher shops and two abattoirs. Today, I travel 60 miles to go to an abattoir. And I go to Brian because I know Brian offers a good service, and we both complement each other.
And that's Brian Lewis in Tipperary, and he's the man I use as well. But I only know about him as a farmer and with the farm shop because of you, Pat, because you still are involved in killing your own animals. I mean, a lot of farmers don't have that anymore.
When we were closed, we brought our animals to Galway to get killed.
I guess abattoirs seem to be coming under stricter and stricter restrictions because it's really hard now to even find... You were saying, with my piglets, they're very cute at the minute, but they're going to be sausages one day. It's hard to find a butcher or an abattoir that can kill pigs.
Yeah, like I have lads, Daltons in Kea, bringing me in pork. They're travelling to Longford to get their pigs killed.
And a man that I was talking to who runs an abattoir, he was saying it would make more sense if the paperwork was different for small-scale abattoirs in comparison to big-scale meat factories.
At
the minute, they have to live up to the standards of the big-scale beef factories who have a dedicated person.
In the big, like, you know, when you're small, you work away, you work hard, but you know what you're producing. You know what the customer is getting. The customer loves it. When I came here first, I couldn't believe every customer came in, they knew exactly what they wanted as they walked in the door.
I mean, you were killing your own beef. Does that help to guarantee some bit of profit in a time when, you know, never seen beef prices like this before?
So it has gone up 40%, 45%, which is hard to make a profit out of that. Like if you're paying rent, you're paying staff, it's impossible to make a profit.
So if you didn't have somewhere to kill your own animals, your profit would be wiped out really this year?
Gone. Yeah, it would make it very hard for me. Very hard. I'm lucky. I'm one of the lucky guys that have my own beef coming on, that I'm not sourcing beef every week, and I have enough at home to keep me going, so I can pick out of my cattle which one I want, and every week and take it from there. Yeah, that's the way I'd like to keep it going. And it's full traceability from my shop, and it's confidence in what you're doing.
So we just have to find somewhere for the pigs.
That's it, John.
That's it. Yeah.
Just a big one.
Yeah. I'll let you get your chops. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thanks, Anna.
Hannah Quinn Mulligan there with Pat Barry at his butcher shop in Croome in Limerick. It's an issue that comes up quite a bit. I was down in Kerry this week and farmers told me that there used to be six small abattoirs on the Dingle Peninsula and now there's none and they have to travel to Killarney. And there are suggestions that a mobile abattoir might be a good solution, something that I know has been piloted in Scotland. But anyway, we'll keep an eye on this. Do get in touch if you're a farmer in similar circumstances, countrywide@rte.ie, and we will come back to it. Well, throughout the country, although the vacant property grant has breathed new life into old empty homes, plenty of houses still sit untouched and some are frozen in time with the belongings of their last residents left just as they were. Well, in the townland of Knockbrack in South Sligo, a small 10-acre farm has stood silent for half a century since 19-year-old Michael O'Hara set off for a new life in Brooklyn in New York back in the mid-1970s. But it was never forgotten. Last week, Michael, with his wife Peggy and their two sons Ryan and Liam, spent time in his home place to walk the land and consider what future might lie ahead for the farm.
My father was born in this house, and so was my grandfather, who was also a Michael O'Hara. This is where the O'Haras come from. This is it.
This is it. Now, were you born in this village too?
I was. I was actually born in the house too.
And why did you leave for America?
My family had all left. I was the last one to leave. And it was me and my father here for the last sort of 5 years. Siblings that went to London and siblings that went to New York. They wanted me to experience something different. So I ended up deciding to leave about a year after high school.
With your father?
No, he was still here. Unfortunately, he passed away within a year. The dilemma with that is I had gone to the United States on a visitor's visa. And I was thinking about it recently because of all the immigration issues they have in the United States.
And this would have been the mid-70s.
The mid-70s. Mm-hmm. This would have been 76 when he got ill. I was stuck in New York. And my siblings, through their kindness, decided he shouldn't go home. Because if he does, he'll never get back in. And that may change his life again.
So your father died a year after you went to America, but because of the visa situation, you were stuck there and you couldn't come home for the funeral.
And so my siblings took care of all the funeral and the neighbours, of course, the wonderful neighbours.
And that must have been immensely difficult.
It was. And I don't really believe that I grieved until my son was born. I really wish if I had to go back again. That I would have found a way to honor, you know, his passing.
And we're standing outside what was his house, is now your house. And I get a feeling that's what you're trying to do now.
Yes. Essentially, it is exactly what I want to do because I've ignored this property for 50 years, and only since I retired have I had the perspective of looking back, wondering what the future of this place could hold.
And was he farming?
Yes. He farmed up to the day he died. I remember the haymaking and the turf making, neighbours helping out, that community living, in a sense, that was years ago. But I enjoyed some parts of it. But then again, I rushed out of here at 19, so clearly I wasn't destined to be a farmer.
Mm, like so many.
That's
like
right.
Like so many. Did he have cattle?
Yes.
Yeah.
He had cattle. We had a pony. We had a donkey. We had some chickens. That's what it was. But he didn't make a living off this farm. When our family was young, he went to Lincolnshire to basically a migrant worker picking potatoes. Like all the neighbors did that.
So he was a seasonal worker in England and would come back and bring the money home.
That's right. Pay off the bills of the store that we owed the money to. You know, that was it. They get paid once a year when he came back. He also worked in London. He spent the winter in London on the construction sites. It was a hard life, and it was a harder life for the people left behind.
But it meant he could stay. Fundamentally, his home was here in Sligo.
That's right. That's right. And eventually, that dream, that thing, did not continue for the next generation. To see the last leave must have been brutal. When I look back, I understand his how hard he worked to give us what we had. But he gave us everything. So.
And we're standing outside of it now. It is a bungalow, side on to the road. Can we go in?
Yeah. Do you guys have a key by any chance?
Ian went to go get it.
Okay,
hi,
fantastic.
There.
Good morning. Very good.
I'm Ella.
This is
Ella,
Ryan.
Nice to meet you, Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
Great to meet you. Lovely weather, huh?
Isn't it?
We're bringing something good, it seems, because 10 years ago we were here and we had another beautiful week.
So the last time you were here was 10 years ago?
Yes.
How has it changed?
It's held its own amazingly through all these horrendous storms and everything.
Solidly made.
It was. It was renovated in the 60s.
Is it as he left inside?
Pretty much. Very Spartan farmhouse.
This is Liam.
Liam. Hi, Liam. How are you?
Peggy.
Hi, Peggy. How are you?
You.
So the whole family's here. How lovely.
So if you want to take a look inside the shack.
Should we go in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
The keys to the kingdom.
Oh, wow. So it's like walking back in time. We walk straight into the kitchen. There's a bed beside the stove. This is very traditional Irish, having a bed beside the stove. I mean, it must have been a place of warmth.
Yes, it was. That's where I slept for quite a while.
To the right. The little room. Fabulous colours on the walls.
The colours don't flow.
Wait till you see the other
room. See the other one.
And then to the other side of the kitchen. Ah, it's a bedroom, a bright pink. Fabulous colour. Sugar pink, I love it. And there is a wardrobe with some, are they your father's clothes?
They might have been some of them, yes.
And there's a fireplace. And there's a Bible.
Yeah.
Are these his glasses here?
They might have been. I don't know if they were. Now, we were looking at that. There's bits and pieces we can't quite connect with.
And what feelings does it bring back or memories when you're in here?
I remember great times here. The neighbours coming in because we're so close to the road. The music, the dancing, you know, the just an incredible place. But I also remember the sadness and of a mother passing in 63. He passed away on her anniversary. I have disconnected from this sort of house because without the people in it, it really means nothing.
Step out into the sun.
Yes, and then we go up the field, and which is, to me, it was, now you want to watch your step going up here.
You said the other day, Dad, the sound of silence. I don't think I fully understood what that truly was until this trip, actually.
You know, everything rotates with the crops season. So this would have been would have been potatoes and oats and barley. A year later, it would be, they'd plant ryegrass or whatever, and the next thing it's meadow for a few years. They treated the earth very well. They knew what they were dealing with. So this is the top of the hill.
So the view opens up completely right across the valley. Now, are we looking towards Mayo there?
Yes, we are.
That is absolutely stunning. Your school was over there?
It was. It's a small national school called Knox School, and it's right over the Mayo border. And it's it was quite a hike, actually.
Cut through the fields.
And I see here in your field, there's livestock here. There's
correct.
Cowpats and all the rest. Your neighbour?
My neighbour, we rent out the pasture to him. We've come to recognise that it's a very small farm, and its use as farmland may be marginal.
What are the options about the future of the farm? Obviously, you can just leave it.
Correct.
And your neighbour will farm away, and the house, presumably, over time, will get more and more damp and all the rest, but that is the option.
That is true. That is one option. Or a part of it can be just ignored and let run wild. So we know what the past was. The future belongs to the next generation.
So Ryan and Liam, any thoughts? Liam, how old are you?
I'm 25.
Okay.
Yeah. Since we've been here the last week, especially because we're able to stay with a neighbor, it makes you think that, you know, having some sort of place here, whether it's a cabin or something, it's a beautiful place where we can stay. And to me, that's something that makes a lot of sense.
And I think we don't really own this land. Right. You know, we're just caretakers. The realization that we're just here for a short while, what would nature want us to do with this land is what I've come back to. The wildlife spends most of the time around here.
Yes.
And we're here maybe once a year if we were to build something small. Maybe twice a year. Just being on this hill and thinking about the possibilities is exciting.
So different from your father's generation in that the pressure is not on you to make money from this land now, is it?
Right.
No.
No, I think that's, we have to accept that. There will be another generation. And if there is some type of place they can come to and visit and
it's
think...
It's very therapeutic. You can't put words on it. It's more than heaven.
I remember I had great plans 50 years ago at some point to come back and do more, fix it up, all of that. And here we are 50 years later, and really nothing has been done. The fact that it's in the family since 1929, and how incredibly important it was for those people that took over the property, my grandfather, to have a property that he owned. He was no longer a tenant farmer. They, that pride that they had in owning, finally owning their own land, it may have skipped my generation a little bit, but now it's back with me. Transferring that to my kids in some way, it gets rid of my guilt. It makes me feel better about whatever happens, that they've connected in some way to this spot. So I'm grateful for my family and the trip home. So.
There's Michael O'Hara with his wife Peggy and their sons Liam and Ryan, who are, I gather, listening to us from New York this morning. They're regular Countrywide listeners. And a day after my visit, Michael actually sent me a message to say that a mini mehel had taken place when his two neighbours, PJ and Patrick, arrived at the farm with their carpentry tools in hand to mend the windows of the old house. And he said the house now has a new cared for look. So kindness and community spirit is still alive and well in Knockbrack. Best of luck to Michael and his family. We'll take a break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
51551. John Stapleton grew up on a small farm near Strokestown in Roscommon. And after going to college in Dublin and then England, the then young food scientist happened to meet a stockbroker with a passion for fresh soup. Back then in the 80s, soup either came dried in a packet or in a tin can. And together they formed a business which pioneered fresh soup in cartons, and they built a multi-million pound brand. Well, John later went on to co-found Little Dish, which made a company that made fresh additive-free meals for toddlers, which was another success. And today he lives in Germany and works as a mentor and investor in food startups, including through the BIA Innovator Hub in Athenryan, Galway, where food businesses can take their first steps into the market. I'm delighted to say John joins me this morning from Munich. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Ella. That's a fantastic introduction. I'm going to use that in the future. That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, most importantly, is your mother listening from Roscommon this morning?
I don't know for sure. I'll let her know. She may not. It may be a little too early for her, but it should definitely get a recording, I guess, at some point. But yeah, she should be listening. She should be listening.
Your success back in the 1980s in the soup market came about because of two things. I mean, you had the scientific know-how, your business partner had the access to cash and a business drive, and together you invented something, and I suppose you'd call it a sort of market disruptor. It reminded me of the story of Tato Crisps and how Joe Spud Murphy and then his employee, Seamus Burke, a bit like yourself, was the one, and they invented the first pre-flavoured crisps. I just wonder, it's quite a high bar, but is that really where the magic can happen for a food business startup to come up with an entirely new product category?
Yeah, the thing about the food industry is that, you know, it has to, it's food or drink, and we're all very familiar with it, which is great. But for, to do something new and different, it has to, you know, appeal to the consumer. So the whole idea was that we wanted to develop a product which existed already, soup, but we wanted to develop fresh soup. Now, it's kind of weird to think that fresh soup didn't exist. It's ubiquitous. It's all over the place these days in lots of formats. But back in 1987, the only liquid soup was in a can. So you had to buy it in a can. And we wanted the soup, less to taste of the process used to make it safe, to give it a long shelf life, which is why canning is. We wanted the soup to taste, funnily enough, of the ingredients we put into it in the first place. And that just wasn't the case. So we were, disruptors. We didn't know it at the time. It's a new word. We didn't use that terminology. But we wanted to give the consumer something we thought that would resonate with them, and you can't explain it. It's kind of like you can't just say describe it. You just got to do it and put it on the shelf and hope it'll work. And it was very successful. It transformed the industry. It was a new category, all those things. But we didn't know that at the time. We were just trying to do something new we thought would appeal to consumers.
And when you were pitching it, I mean, did people think you were crazy? Did people immediately say, "Wow, that's a great idea"?
A few people thought it was a great idea, but I think they're just being kind to us rather than say to our face that everybody told us it was a crazy, crazy idea. All of the industry basically told us it was a crazy idea. All those people, all those experts who should have known better, and we were listening to it going, I wonder, are they right? The food scientists told us we'd kill somebody because you have to make it safe. Liquid soup has to be in a can, which is a conventional wisdom, which is why it's in a can. You'll kill somebody if you don't sterilize it. And when we sold the business, 10 years later, we had made 50 million cartons of soup. And to my knowledge, we hadn't killed one person. So that was proved wrong. And then the experts in the food industry said, you'll never get the space from the retailers. They protect that chilled space. They put their own products in there. You're not going to put a brand in there. There was no brands in the chilled space. And the third thing is they said the carton is a crazy idea. Milk goes in a carton. You don't put soup in a carton. Now, all those things, we could have listened to them and they were kind of right. But that is the conventional wisdom speaking. And that, if you're listening to what, only ever happened in the past, you'd never do anything new in the future. We wanted to do something new in the future. And we were young and tenacious and we didn't listen. We just cracked on regardless. But we were told it wouldn't work for sure.
I just wonder, farms, whether big or small, give a lot of people their first kind of entrepreneurial experience. You can learn an awful lot, as hard as it is, from things like bad harvests or bad prices. You come through, you keep going, and you can experiment and take risks. You grew up on a small beef farm. Is it too obvious to ask you, did it in any way shape how you were in business, or did you turn your back on the farm and have to kind of train up completely separately to that?
That's a great question. And I'm often asked that. I think in the earlier part of my career, I would have said farming and entrepreneurship have nothing to do with each other. They're so far apart from each other. But the more I think about it, the more that's not the case. I think, life is very unpredictable. Life is very uncertain. And on a farm, as you say, you're open to those experiences. And entrepreneurship is all about taking advantage of uncertainty and take advantage of unpredictability and seeing an opportunity. Many businesses are born out of uncertainty. And I think also, certainly a small farm in the west of Ireland is very, very practical and down to earth, and you don't suffer fools gladly, and you're not afraid of hard work. And all those things are great benefits for setting up your own business and going into business. And I think you're also, you've got to deal with adversity. Adversity comes in all sorts of shapes and forms. And I remember, maybe one anecdote I can tell you about, my dad had this farm in Roscommon. I remember 1970 is my earliest memory, a long, long time ago. I was a little six-year-old. And next to the farmyard, next to the farmhouse, is this wonderful field that I used to play in. And we used to put the calves out to aftergrass. And they used to be normally frolicking around. And one day my dad brought me into the field, and this was not that unusual. And he used to whistle as he walked the land. This day he wasn't whistling. And there was no movement in the field, although the calves were in there. And as we got closer and closer, I realized, oh my God, there's calves here, right? But they're all like either dying or dead. And they're lying there with this horrible kind of bloated stomachs and legs stiff, pointing up into the air. And it was a huge shock for me. And apart from, of course, this was going to be a disaster for the family business and the finances, which I didn't really understand at the time. It was a huge shock. And this terrible death was visiting a place which I, called home, which is next door. I remember asking my dad in a very innocent way, "Dad, these calves are all dead. Are we going to die too?" And he just looked at me and said, "No, this is not a good place to be, but we're just going to buy some more calves and we'll be all right." And I just felt a huge relief, you know,
a huge business lesson. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there are things outside your control you can't deal with, and life is full of adversity, and it's going to keep throwing at you. And you just, you know, if you're going to set up a business, that's a great lesson to learn. But as a 6-year-old, it's even better. You know, you grow up with that feeling, and nothing can prepare you for that feeling. I don't think you can. You know, that's my story. Other people have different stories. But that little story, a little anecdote, stuck with me. I'm still talking about it now, many, many years later.
And on your website.
That's the sort of thing farming gives you.
Yeah, on your website, beside the section in your timeline where you tried to break into the American market with your soup business, which was not successful, you have two words. You say it failed. You lost money and you got out of it then. I mean, that presumably you knew then to cut and run and not to continue in that business in America. It was a very different situation to the success that you had in the UK.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that was very much a down point. You know, there was kind of like a valley of darkness there for sure. And I guess sometimes it happens to people, but they don't have a success beforehand. So even that juxtaposition, that comparison was there, you know, setting up a new category, doing fresh soup, trying to do the same thing in the US. You know, how difficult can it be? Well, the answer in hindsight was very difficult. It didn't work. And I think you have to be honest with yourself and say that you know, it failed, because you can try and couch it up and, oh, we got a lot right, which we did, but not enough right to make it successful. And I think, you know, I went out there saying to everybody, investors and staff and retailers, follow me, I know what I'm doing, pointing to what happened in London, which is a success, a new idea. We went out there and we did it. And then we're going to do the same in the States. And it didn't work. So it was kind of a feeling of let everybody down and you know, wasn't able to do what I said I was going to do. So the thing about that is, though, Ella, is failure is a great lesson. You know, success is a lousy teacher, but failure, it's not a great place to be. But actually, if you have the wherewithal to look back on it, it's a good place to have been, because it hurts like hell. And it kind of galvanizes you to, certainly galvanize me, to swear that you're never going to have to feel that pain again. And there's a bit of redemption involved, so I don't want to overemphasize it. But, you know, you're sitting there thinking, crikey, what went wrong? And it's all down to me. But it galvanizes you to never feel that pain again.
Looking ahead.
And I think, you know, I would say a lot of the time my third business was a success because my second one was a failure. So
this
I think
was
you know,
the toddler's
okay to
business.
Fail.
Yeah. I mean, looking ahead, I just wonder, and it's an obvious point that your food will always be a safe bet because people have to eat. But if you look at the use of things like weight loss drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic, how much will they disrupt the food industry? I know Morgan Stanley estimates that by 2035, which isn't that long away, 24 million people in America will be on these drugs, which means that they're going to be cutting their calories and they're going to be eating differently. Is this an area that food businesses in Ireland should be looking at?
That's a crazy statistic when you think about it. It is just over the hill, isn't it? Well, to answer your question, I'm never a great believer or a great fan of like what I call is like the pill solution. Take a pill and it'll solve the problem. I think we have to be more disciplined. However, we've been saying this for years, you know, and it's not enough to say to blame the consumer for the obesity epidemic. I think they take their fair share of it. But the food industry has been complicit. And we've been talking about, you know, the food industry changing its ways for decades. But there's such a lot of self-interest to producing these sort of products which encourage obesity, you know, basically ultra-processed foods and calorie-dense foods, and they're cheap. That's why the food industry loves it and make high margins. So that's a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if this, you know, these sort of GLP drugs or this sort of thing forces the food industry to not produce and not market those sort of, you know, unhealthy products, it forces them to look at, because they're very cheap alternatives, focuses them to look at generating and marketing and really bringing to market healthy alternatives, then that's a good thing. Now there are lots of questions about this. I don't know what the long-term side effects of these drugs would be, and nobody has the, you know, the epidemiological test to point to that to say they're safe. We don't know. We might be creating a can of worms here, but the food industry really needs an impetus, because all that's going to happen is such a lot of self-interest here to continue to produce these products because you can make money out of them, a lot more money than healthy products. And that's the reality of the situation. So if something forces them to address this, that, you know, probably is not a bad thing.
Well, it's been a very successful career you've had. I'm very grateful for you for joining us this morning from Munich. And if you want to know more about John or contact him, you can go to johnstapleton.eu. John, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Ellie, you're very welcome. Love to speak to you. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Well, we heard last week about the devastating death of tens of thousands of fish along the river Blackwater. And it's a stark reminder, of course, of the active efforts we all need to make to look after our rivers, lakes, coasts and wetlands. Tomorrow is Water Heritage Day, which is all about that, to celebrate water. And there are events all around the country. Well, Ronan Kelly decided to hop on board a traditional barge which travels along the Grand Canal from Salon in Kildare. He joined other passengers to explore the nature in and along the waterway, guided by Chris McKenna.
So first of all, just so there's no misconceptions or nobody's under any illusions, I have no formal qualifications in any area of biodiversity. I am what you would call an enthusiastic amateur, just so you know. The only thing I'm formally qualified to do is drive this boat. Keep an eye on the water as we're going along. A lot of people forget to look in the water. It's crystal clear, as you can see, and there's lots of fish in there. We have roach, rub, green, tench, perch, pike and eels.
Well, we have a water hen and her chicks on the left. Hello, Mrs. That's a female, yeah. The yellowy, greeny one is a female. You'll see her flying low and dipping her abdomen into the water to lay eggs.
Oh, it's such a brilliant day.
And they
so,
don't
yeah.
bite her, okay.
Yeah.
What are you hoping to see here? What's he...
Fish.
You're looking to see fish, right?
Fish.
You'll see lots of fish. This is unique. It's not just fresh water. This is actually spring water. This canal is filled from Pollardstown Fen. So Pollardstown Fen is a natural spring-fed fenland on the edge of the Curra. Underneath the Curra Plains in Kildare is a massive underground lake which bubbles up in Pollardstown Fen as springs. So when they dug the canal, they dug a feeder line into the fen. So that's what feeds the canal. So this is all spring water, which explains why Guinness used to use this water to make the Guinness back in the day. There's also a very specific beetle called Denisia clavipes, which lives exclusively on this plant here, this freshwater reeds. And its larval stage lives under the waterline, in the water, immersed in the water. And they are only found in good quality water. And we find them regularly here in Salons. You'll see the dragonflies patrolling over the open water, but the damselflies tend to stay near the vegetation at the sides. And the difference between dragonflies and damselflies is that damselflies rest with their wings resting down along their body, aligned with their body, whereas dragonflies rest with their wings sticking out to the side. Now, they both have six legs, but neither of them can walk. Their legs aren't articulated for walking. They're articulated for grabbing other insects in flight when they're hawking. That's what it's called when they chase down other insects, because that's what they eat. But if they want to move up a stem, they literally have to let go and fly up and grab on again. Their legs are not articulated for walking very well. See you lots, see you
lots. I grew up in Mayo and I remember seeing these in the bogs.
Oh.
The dragonflies. And they'd be near water all right.
He has four wings. Yeah, I don't know what he is now. They're a fabulous colour, aren't they? The bluey kind of ones.
The red-shaped plant that you see at the top. You can also see, and mixed in with it there, some of our lily pads. Now, most of you, when you see lily pads, you expect to see that lovely white and pink delicate flower that you're used to from Disney movies with a frog sitting on it. And that's an ornamental variety. You won't see that in the canals. Our Irish native variety has a yellow flower, which you'll see as we're going along. And if you look along the banks there, there's a white feathery kind of flower growing all along it there in vast numbers. That's actually meadowsweet. Back in the day, meadowsweet was the source of aspirin tablets. They used to grow it commercially and harvest it to extract the active ingredient called acetylsalicylic acid, which is a natural painkiller. So nowadays they do it synthetically. But also meadowsweet was used to stuff mattresses for settle beds. Old cottages years ago in Ireland had a settle bed. It was like a bench with a mattress in it, for visitors that would turn up and want to stay over. So they stuffed it with the meadowsweet, which is a natural deodorant, which would help improve the smell of the unwashed bodies of the guests staying in the mattress. We're going to step off here at the aqueduct, as I said, which is where the canal crosses over the River Liffey. One thing eats another. They all have to survive. You can't interfere. We can't be so naive about nature. We really need to wake up that nature is not what you see in Disney movies. People really need to learn that, because I see people, why didn't you throw stones at that heron when he was taking a duck? Why would I? That's his dinner. I'm not going to deprive him. You can't deprive one over the other. It's a real eye-opener when people find out how nature actually works. So we're going to get a look at some of the plants here. We have here the humble nettle, which most people, again, regard as a weed and a terrible thing, and they cut it down. It's one of the most important food sources for all butterfly species in Ireland. An awful lot of butterflies lay their eggs near nettles for the caterpillars to use as a food source.
What about nettle soup?
We were reared on it years ago. Yes. There was no cabbage. It was your bacon was boiled with nettles, and you ate it whether you liked it or not. They're very nutritious. I tend to stay away from the foraging stuff because there's so many things that are poisonous that if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, I don't recommend anybody eat anything. Because basically, it's too dangerous, because people will misidentify something. Yeah. They'll eat it, they'll get sick, and they'll blame me. I didn't tell you to eat that, you know. So you have to be careful. Now, so I done a bit of a moth trapping last night, just so I'd have a few moths to show you. So if you want to step over near the wall, I had them in the fridge to keep them cool. They're a bit sleepy. I'm going to let one out so you can see it. Hopefully he'll fly off after a couple of minutes. So if he flies, you'll see he's got a beautiful yellow. Oh, there he goes. See the yellow on him? So that's a yellow underwing. So see this? A macro moth.
Whoa.
So that's a big one. That's a poplar hawk moth. It's one of the hawk moth species.
Whoa.
This is a lovely one called a burnished brass. And if you look at his wing, it looks like metal. Now this one, if he'd settle, is a really interesting one. It's called a Chinese character. It's a very unusual shape. Big fish behind you now. Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Full of them. It's absolutely chock-a-block with fish.
What are they, Eva?
Fishies.
Oh, yes, little brown ones.
And there's also a big one.
It looked like it had orange fins.
So you have four kids with you here today. Was it difficult to persuade them to come out?
No, I didn't tell them. It was a surprise this morning. So I booked it and I said, we're going on a surprise adventure this morning. And then we just rocked up.
So I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned at least one new thing anyway. Or at least it gave you an appetite to go out and look for yourself a bit more and take those walks along the canal. And like I said, take the time to stop every now and again for about 10 minutes and just look around and see what plants and insects are there. It's really well worth your while. Oh, I hope you enjoyed that.
I really did. Thank you very much. Thank you so much.
No bother.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Roland Kelly there with Chris McKenna guiding a nature tour along the Grand Canal from Salins in Kildare. And for more, go to bargetrip.ie. And for water Heritage Day events across the country, go to heritageweek.ie. Now, before we go, a quick word about the return of school next week. It's upon us earlier than ever this year. But if you live in rural Ireland, as 35% of our population does, it is all but assumed that cycling to school is an impossibility. Katrina Corr co-authored Rougher Roads, which is a vision for cycling in rural Ireland. And she joins me from Cork. Katrina, you're very welcome. I know we have this amazing dense network of lovely, beautiful small back roads, which are potentially safe for cycling. What is your vision?
Well, I think this vision came about after COVID, when we saw the huge change in behaviour on rural roads. There was children and teenagers back using our rural roads again, that huge network that you spoke about. And Joe Sachs Eldridge is based in Leitrim, and I think there was a group of people across the country who just wanted to not lose what we had gained over COVID with this change in behaviour. So Rougher Roads is a concept about making sure that cyclists are expected and respected on rural roads, and using the most of what we already have, I suppose, to expand on the active travel network that has currently been built out across the country.
Yeah, because I was interested, by law, motorways are for cars only, but other roads like these back roads, they are for cyclists, walkers, horse riders, people moving cows, motorcyclists and car drivers. It's all equal. I mean, they should and can be used by everyone. I just wonder How do you make these Ruhr roads safe? So if you're thinking about kids potentially being able to cycle to school in rural Ireland along these roads, how do you begin to make them safe?
Well, one of the first objectives that was listed in that concept actually was a reduction in the speed limits. And that's something that we have seen, you know, and we have seen that initial reduction in speed limits. But I do think it's recognised that even sharing the road with vehicles travelling at 60 kilometres an hour is not safe. You know, we need to bring down that speed limits a little bit more, or perhaps it's on these sections that we identify as Ruhr roads that we create gateways and that we create treatments on the roads that make drivers know that you're now entering a space that is shared with walkers or cyclists. And I suppose we're talking about the roads that people who live in Ireland, in rural Ireland, are familiar with, the roads that people love walking on, the roads that people love cycling on because they're quieter, they're very low trafficked anyway. That's the type of road network that we're talking about. But perhaps we need some additional elements. So we need a transition maybe. When drivers come to this junction, there might be a surface treatment and certainly signage telling people that you're now sharing the road. And at the time when we spoke about the Ruhr Road concept, we said this might be for children going to school, but it could also be about drawing attention to our heritage and to our traditions, and that we have holy wells throughout Ireland. We have, you know, can we display our old farm machinery? Is there ways that we can create little points of interest around this network of roads? So it was, I think, about, you know, classifying. So this is going to be a Ruhr Road in this locality.
And are there any pilots out there at the moment, any sections of roads across Ireland where Ruhr roads are or will happen?
Well, I suppose what's very exciting at the moment is the pilot that's happening in Blacksod Bay in Mayo. And this has been driven by TII and Mayo County Council. So this is the closest thing to what we would, to the concept of the Ruhr Road. And it, of course, such a beautiful part of Ireland, and slowing the creating surface treatments along the road and signage and road markings to let people know that this is going to be a quiet road and this is going to be a cycle route. So that's definitely the first step.
And it's extraordinary, really, because when you look at the data, I was amazed to read that between 1986 and 2011, when the number of cars on Irish roads doubled, the number of secondary school students travelling to school daily by bike dropped by 87%. I mean, that's just an absolute, I mean, it's astonishing to think of the past when really these roads would have been full of kids going to school.
That's it, and I think what it really represents is a huge loss in independence travel for our young people, and a huge loss in the freedom that comes with that. And we would, so many of our generation would have travelled to school on bikes, but also to our activities and to socialise. That's how we travel to meet our friends. So that was a huge part of life for young people that we have lost. But I suppose what's been really positive, the last census period was the first time when the numbers have, that trend has started to be reversed. Mm. So that's something that's really positive. But that trend has been reversed in urban areas. So it's how do we go and bring that to the rural areas as well?
Well,
and it's all about the perception of safety.
Well, Katrina Corr of Ruhr Roads, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And if you want to know more about it, you can go to cyclist.ie and you can read the proposal. Well, that's it for this week. Philip is back next week. My thanks to Eileen Heron, to Amandine Passett-Devine and Tommy O'Sullivan. Until we speak again, many thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.